Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Immigration, the health service, and the welfare budget when it comes to people claiming and scrounging off the state. Well, we all get a bit hot under the collar, but how much of what we know is reality and how much of it is merely perception in politics?
It's what we're about. It's a way of life. It's about our values. It's how we do our politics.
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, you hear politicians going on all the time about fraud in the welfare system and people who are work shy when it comes to getting a job. But you look at the statistics and you find that actually 0.7%, so not even 1% of welfare claims are fraudulent. And you also see that less than 4% of the welfare budget is actually spent on people on out-of-work benefits. In the studio is Hear Hear's guest of the week is the political commentator, LBC radio presenter and all-round good chap Ian Collins. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Now, this is something that has really got to you in the past, the notion of what people believe versus reality.
Yeah, I mean, you just cited some figures that sort of minimalise some of the headlines that we hear in, particularly in newspapers such as the Daily Mail. They seem to come under attack.
Yeah, they're going to come up a lot today.
If you begin to add up, I mean, there's two points there. If you begin to add up all those various figures, you know, I constantly hear lots of opposition politicians say, well, actually, this is only 0.2% and that's only 1% and this is only 0.5%. When you start to add all of that up, it does begin to form a sizable figure. In addition to that, it's what one's definition of fraud actually is. Now, sure, fraud as in doing something illegal, trying to claim money that isn't rightly yours, that's one definition of fraud, and clearly that's a matter of criminality. Whether the system itself is built in to allow what some would call the fraudulent use of is another issue, and that's where I think you'd start to see higher figures. So if, for example, somebody decides that they're going to have three kids, fake a fallout with their mum so they get their own flat, etc. I happen to have first-hand experience of this within my own, let's say, my own circle. You know, that's not classed as fraud. That's actually classed as a legitimate claim. That's somebody who then gets their place to live in. I'm not saying this happens on every street, but I think it probably happens more than we are perhaps led to believe. That person is legit. They're not counted as fraudulent. And yet, the entire notion and lifestyle of that person, one could argue, is fraudulent in itself.
Well, I mean, it could be. But I mean, you listen to politicians, you listen to Ian Duncan Smith, and actually even the Labour Party, who are kind of grappling with the Tories to be harshest on welfare, at least it seems. It's not to minimise when it happens. It's really not. But the impression that you get is there are so many work-shy scroungers running about the place who don't want to work. And on this
it's interesting because that's another. This is a fantastic element of the whole perception reality argument. Because there's another point there that nobody ever said any of those. Nobody came out with any of those words about scroungers and people who can't be bothered to work.
No, they say work-shy though. And George Osborne said that it's not fair on people who get up at 7 o'clock in the morning,
go out
to work, and then they're sitting in their house with the curtains closed.
But a Chancellor of the Exchequer, the bloke who controls the money, is not allowed to make a point about that contingent of society, then there's something really wrong with democracy. It's not North Korea, for goodness sake.
Fine, but
he's allowed to make
that's not
that
the constituents
point
of society, is it?
No, but
if you bear in mind, it's a tiny, minute percentage of people
agreed,
who have
to
work benefit.
What's happened with the bunch of scroungers and the idea that all Tories, and I don't represent any party, by the way, but the idea that all Tories hate the poor, this kind of guff that's put around by the sort of, who's that guy played by the Alan Bennett character? Owen Jones, that's him. Yeah, that kind of thinking. You look at what they're saying and think, actually, it's only them using these words. They're using these words and attributing to the people who never actually use some of those phrases.
But isn't that really politicians' medicine being forced down their own throats?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's what politicians do. But it's interesting that when somebody says to Ian Duncan Smith, you think all poor people or disabled people are scroungers, he's never said that, nor does he think that for one second. Probably nobody in frontline politics has worked harder to establish the facts of the welfare system than Ian Duncan Smith. You might disagree with the way he's gone about it. You might disagree with elements of what he's trying to do. I mean, these are very small cuts, by the way, in comparison to what we've seen under previous administrations in the 70s, for example, when they cut 4% of the budget in 1 year. I mean, this government, I think, are cutting 2% over the entire entire term. So in context, it's very small. But nonetheless, if somebody accuses Ian Duncan Smith of that kind of thing, he's then got to defend it. So he's got to say, no, I'm not somebody who thinks this of the poor or the disabled. And then before
why does he get asked if that perception is there?
Well, because it's a wonderful argument, usually put around by the yoghurt-knitting left, that Tories, rich, posh, Etonian swines that have never done a day's work really in their life, are lording it up, all living in beautiful palatial homes with a butler and several servants and jump on poor people as they walk out of the house in the morning. I mean, this is just utter garbage.
Off the fence, Collins.
How old are these people? 9? For goodness sake. I mean, what do these Tories say to their kids? Dad, what's a poor person? Oh, a poor person is somebody we don't like very much.
Much
like
feces.
If you see them, try and avoid them like the plague. You know, my goodness. I mean, this is where political discourse has taken us into this sort of conduit of schoolyard discussion.
Yeah, but whose fault is that? Because actually, if politicians are going to enter into that kind of debate in the first place, there is at least an element that politicians, frankly, soil themselves at the very fear of bad headlines sometimes.
They come in.
David Cameron came and he said, we're not going to play to the media agenda, yet everything is perception.
Yeah, well, they do, of course. Look, all politicians are guilty of this. Looking at PMQs just this week, you know, it was a pretty poor performance from Ed and a pretty poor performance from David Cameron. I didn't really see anybody coming out of that and, you know, Bob from Arbroath thinking, hey, what a swell couple of politicians we've got there. I mean, it was just appalling stuff, really.
I know who does get on your nerves. Shall we take a listen?
David Cameron's government has done next to nothing. Their economic plan is failing and they don't know what to do. Plan A, Plan B, Plan A+, with this government, I don't see any plan at all.
Ian Edballs, why does he irritate you?
Well, every time I hear this man speak, I want to start instinctively eating my own face, to be honest. I mean, this is a fella that, for the last 13 years, was right in the thick of it, in all matters Treasury-related. Even before becoming an MP, he was there advising Brown, writing speeches, telling him which direction to go, then becomes the City Minister, spectacularly misses the LIBOR scandal, has no idea what went on. Sorry, Gov, I don't know what happened there. Well, you're the City Minister, mate. You didn't know what had happened. He either did know what happened and chose to ignore it, in which case that's probably a matter of illegality, or he did know what happened and did nothing about it, in which case it makes him completely and utterly incompetent. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the two. He's actually saying to people, 5 minutes ago, I was there in the Treasury when it all went wrong. I'm not suggesting for 1 second, by the way, just to clarify this point, that it was Labour's fault that banks collapsed. But they were the government of the day. They do have a degree of responsibility. One cannot, with a straight face, say that, well, it was nothing to do with them at all. To be the government of the day and not notice that people on 18 grand a year were buying £350,000 houses, or the lollipop lady had a property portfolio, was, you know, frankly, such breathtaking incompetence that it should render most of the front bench not just unfit to form a government next time around in 2015, but frankly, it should render them unfit to show their face in public.
Yeah, I get the point. And they all do this, politicians. They all say the other lot were to blame.
But they were in half an hour ago, Sean. They were in power.
3 years ago.
They were in power. Look, you can't clear up an international global meltdown in 2.5 years.
Why was there a promise to balance the books?
Well,
a promise to do it
at the end of the parliament, and that's their aspiration. They
definitely can't happen now. We're looking 2018.
Also, you've got to remember, in 2010, we didn't expect there to be another global meltdown shortly afterwards, and that's the bit that gets brilliantly forgotten over this.
So
for the record, I think that you. As any government of the day, you have an aspiration to want to do something. Had the Tories been in power from 1997 to 2010, exactly the same thing would have happened with the banks. They also would have probably turned a blind eye to personal debt and credit going out of control. My point really is there isn't much of a difference. There's just the perception of difference. And depending on where you sit, so if you are a bit of a lefty, I mean, it is extraordinary to see, I mean, even the front bench, these lovely Blairites that sat there being all good and nice and centrist all that time, you know, the minute they were kicked out of office, suddenly started tweeting and bickering like they were George Galloway.
They all do it. Do you not think that?
I mean, they went back to their old CND union credentials. He had Jack Straw and Blunkett and the like, all these guys that were purveyors of Blairism, suddenly deciding, actually, now the shackles are off, let's go back to what we... Trotsky's, all of a lot of us, and every one of them was happy to put their name to a completely different sort of ideology to the one they'd been voted in for the last 13 years.
Well, again, it's perceptions and they peddle this. And on that point, I want to bring in Martin Robbins, who's columnist for Vice magazine and blogger for The Guardian and New Statesman. Martin, hello, sir.
Hello.
Now, one of the points that you pick up on in terms of perception versus reality is the Daily Mailism that you would describe.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not exactly the most reality-based newspaper, I'd argue.
But is it restricted to the Daily Mail? Because, of course, you get all sorts of journalistic ethics that are very similar. A court video of yourself talking about the notion of immigration and people's feelings on welfare as a result of maybe the way that you might argue journalists skew things.
You know, all journalists are writing from their own sort of perception of reality, and readers tend to choose the journalists to read that agree most with their own sense of reality. Everyone has their own idea and their own preconceptions about what society's like, what Britain's like, and they tend to gravitate towards the newspapers and the journalists that agree with them most of the time.
Well, this is a theory, Ian, you had recently on your LBC radio show about the Mail, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wonder, Martin, whether there's... I mean, is there anything wrong with a genre, if you like? And let's remember the word tabloid is not a euphemism for bad journalism. It is merely a genre of journalism, and when done well, it's an admirable genre in itself. But, I mean, there's always been room for the dramatic, the hyperbolic, the grotesque. And, you know, the Mail, along with, you know, I would say, you know, Channel 4, when they show a programme, the Man with 10 Stone Testicles, you know, it's all trying to find stories that stand out, the water cooler moment. They're not suggesting the entire country is of these ilks or representative of these stories. They're just individual tales, anecdotes, if you like, that make for some interesting reading.
Well, I'd agree and disagree. I mean, I agree with you that there's maybe a bit of snobbishness towards tabloid culture from kind of middle-class critics who see it as kind of a bit beneath proper journalism. And you know, I do think that there's an art to sensationalism and hyperbole, and that it's kind of good to have people exploring those different types of journalism. I think tabloid journalism done well can be a really great thing. I think the danger is when you reach the point that, you know, you have this kind of corrosive thing where you have a set of pre-existing beliefs and you kind of get them not just reinforced but whipped up further. And
is it a belief, though, Martin, or is it the fact that they're judging their audience? You know, there's this whole thing with the Sun. It was the Sun what won it with the election. It was the Sun what guessed what public opinion was. And surely that's what Paul Dacre at the Mail and others would do, is really infotainment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I don't believe that it was the Sun what won it. People voted the way they were going to vote to some extent, and the Sun picked up on those trends and very wisely decided to tell their readers what they wanted to hear, and then they picked up credit for it later on. The Sun always seems to switch sides when it looks like the opponents are winning. They never sort of go 5 years in advance.
Yeah, but my point being, is that not what the Mail are doing in terms of that, you know, they're writing, I don't know, immigrant, gypsy, lesbians or whatever, the most sensational and often offensive headlines. You know, there was one earlier this week talking about a bisexual man arrested for a murder. His sexuality had nothing to do with it.
But that's tabloid, isn't it? I mean, that's just throwing in bits of information about somebody to spike the interest of a certain readership.
Yeah, but you couldn't say, you
wouldn't get that in The Guardian or The Telegraph.
You couldn't say, could you? Even the Mail couldn't say black murderer. So why can you say bisexual?
You can say. You can point out that somebody's ethnicity in the story of a murder case.
I mean, I think it goes both ways. I mean, I do agree that the extent to which tabloids can influence people is overrated. I don't think tabloids set people's opinions to start with. What I think they can do that it can be dangerous is reinforce those prejudices and help them to build a bit further. And I think perhaps we've seen that to some extent with attitudes towards disabled people claiming benefits, for example.
But isn't there a kind of a perfect storm at the moment? Because, you know, you've got lots of sort of nicely educated, middle-class lefties discombobulating left, right and centre at the idea that, well, usually at the idea that the Daily Mail exists at all. And if you chime that in with what's happening with what they laughably call austerity cuts and all the rest of it, put the two together, the Mail probably hasn't changed its style or its number count on those kind of stories at all in the last few years. The other day we were doing a radio show. We attempted to find the story of the woman with 25 kids whose house was made of flat screens. And we had to go back about 4 weeks of the Mail to actually actually find one. It surprised us that we couldn't actually find one. However, there is a sort of a feeling out there at the moment that for some reason the Mail prints a story about somebody who should be working and isn't, and they may or may not be disabled, and they're claiming money. And then this idea that there's a correlation between a story in the Mail and attacks on the disabled. Now, I find it really hard to believe that Bob and Madge Smithers of Tunbridge Wells were so incensed by what they read in the Mail that they went out and beat up folk in wheelchairs. I mean, that probably didn't happen, but there is a sort of a bit of mischief-making that comes from the left here, which I would sort of argue is as unhealthy as the very thing that the left are arguing against.
Well, do you know, actually, funny enough, Martin, you've written a piece recently about perceptions when it comes to the welfare budget. We spoke a bit about it earlier, but the notion that the way politicians are speaking, everybody would think that every other person was scrounging.
Again, I think there's two kind of aspects to this. I mean, first of all, I don't think that things have to be incredibly obvious and overt to have a potentially damaging effect further down the line. You can achieve problems with a steady kind of drip, drip, drip of stories over time. But what I think actually the really important point to make here is, you know, when you talk about the left and their reaction to this, it is, you know, and I've been guilty of this in the past, to some extent fixating on the Daily Mail rather than perhaps the people who read the Daily Mail or read it as a...
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most popular news sites actually in the world, it has to be said.
Sure.
I'd like to think that in terms of papers, I'm relatively balanced, as well as Ian Collins, incidentally, we review papers for various news organisations here and there. But it's one of the first papers you look at, not because you think, oh, OK, it's 100% factual, but it almost kind of gives you a sense of where public opinion is, even if it's unpalatable and uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, that's their job to some extent, is to, you know, go out. I mean, ultimately, the Daily Mail, I mean, I've looked at this in the past and I've tried to identify specific lines they've taken on, you know, health journalism, for example, and often there isn't really one, and the stories seem pretty random. They take different sides of the debate at various times, and the main sort of correlation is that the Daily Mail in the internet age are extremely good at attracting hits and very good at search engine optimization.
Are we not missing a bigger point here? That what I think it in part has happened is that for 13 years, left-wingers, and I mean sort of true left-wingers, people who believe in the real values of the left, have kept shtum and allowed the name Labour to just come forward and disagreed with it, but been very, very good rallying around leaders, even when the likes of Philip Green were being knighted. Nobody said anything about Topshop and offshore tax affairs then. Suddenly, you put the Tories in power, marry that up with the Daily Mail, and the world's collapsed all of a sudden. Well, all of this stuff was already going on. Where on earth were some of the dissenters back then? That's what I find vaguely fascinating.
Yeah, OK, I've got to ask this question, though, because there'll be people listening thinking you're a raging Tory.
No, I don't. I'm not a member of any of these parties, but my interest, as I said at the beginning, is that of perception and reality. And I do find it rather interesting that, you know, the UK Uncut. I mean, whether you agree or disagree with what's happening with the coalition and offshore tax, as just an example, we're straying slightly here, but, you know, at least it's now on the agenda, whereas previously it wasn't. Everything was still going on. Gaps between rich and poor were getting wider, but everybody kept rather quiet about it. And now people that were happy to sign up to the Labour super dream between 97 and 2010, jumping up like left-wing meerkats, thinking, hang on, what's going on here? It's tax avoiders, it's lower tax rates for the rich, it's Paul Dacre, it's the Daily Mail, it's bash disabled people, and mashing together a bunch of narratives and stories that don't really connect, but if you have if you want to create an overarching story, they kind of have a feel. I mean, it's almost as if some of that mischief-making is as bad as the very journalism some people are attacking.
Do you know what? I think you're right in terms of perception, but you mentioned the meerkat, and I think, unfortunately, what the next election will come down to is people will compare the market, .com and look what's happening with the economy at the time.
That's the funniest thing you've ever said.
Fair, thank you very much indeed. I'll stick it in the diary. But I think it's a fair point that really all of this is irrelevant when it comes to people going to the polls.
Yeah, I mean, there's another kind of big bugbear I have, which is, you know, people like us sit here and talk about, oh, the economy is going to make this happen or that happen, and talk about the influence of the Daily Mail. But a lot of this conversation is pretty out of touch with the average person. If I speak to any member of my family about
Correct.
This kind of stuff, they don't talk about half of the things that we talk about on Twitter or among the kind of pundit class, as it were.
Absolutely.
Or the amateur
pundit class. I like that. I'm going to put that in the diary as well. Listen, last word to you, Martin, then. The cause of skewed realities, the perceptions that people we have, can be summed up how in the United Kingdom?
It's people looking for the stories they want to hear.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo. Sign up for your free account now.
And you can do that at audioboo.fm. You can check out the show, hearhearshow.co.uk, and you can follow us on Twitter at hearhearshow. Ian Collins, the LBC radio presenter and political commentator with us. You're also the presenter of the Ian Collins Wants a Word podcast.
Yes, I think I was the only person that they could really get to do it, given that they'd already put the name Ian Collins on it. So
tell us about it. I mean, I listen to this every week.
Yes, well, it's a very antithesis, really, as to, you know, what I do the rest of the time, which is, yeah, you know, covering news stories and politics. And the idea of this really was for it to be a complete departure from anything like that. It's myself, producer guy, I don't really want to rate him because I don't, called Sideshow Kev. Yeah. And between the two of us, we chew the fat. We talk to people like James May, Andy Zaltzman, Jason Manford, whoever, yeah, we have on that particular week. We lark around. We talk about more from the popular culture side of things, things that annoy us, ways to solve the world, ways to make the world a better place.
Anything annoys you, Ian, you know, frankly.
Yeah, well, random acts of irrational annoyance, which, yeah, has become our, you know, almost
blocked. How often does Ed Balls come up in your world here?
Yeah, usually on a weekly basis. But that one feature has, you know, almost blocked our entire Twitter feed.
The thing is, it's funny, isn't it? Because what you do with Once a Word, and it has to be said you were doing that before the existence of Hear. But it's that kind of professional radio show type thing, I guess, new media in a way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, podcasting, as you know, it works on sort of a number of levels. There's the bedroom podcasting, which, you know, you can sit there and just talk into your iPhone and make a pod if you want to, and make a podcast if you want. You can put that up there. Or there's tailor-made, if you like, deliberately constructed podcasts that are produced and put together in the vein with the production values of a radio show. I mean, this would be another example of that.
I mean, is that going to grow that genre? Because
I think without doubt. I mean, if you look at the, you know, how many people listen, you know, online now to audio, whether that's on their computer or on their phone, I mean, that figure is just going up and up. I mean, that's...
And what a brilliant time to suggest that people hosting podcasts might want to have a look at audiobook.fm as
well. Well, absolutely right. But, I mean, people listen through... I talk to my niece, and you ask my niece which radio station she listens to, and she's just one step away from saying, what's radio? Because, you know, most of what she listens to is she'll listen to music on her phone, and she'll listen to podcasts on her phone. So she will be listening to radio, but it will be via the mechanism of a phone or some other audio device. So everything has changed in that respect.
How do people get Once a Word?
You go to iTunes, or unless you're an Android user, whichever one you prefer, and just search Once a Word.
Fantastic. OK, that's Ian Collins, Once a Word. Let's get back to the subject of perception versus reality in politics. We've looked at issues such as welfare, the NHS. One of the issues I want to get onto is international aid. Joined on the line by Kieran Pedley from polling company Comres. This is one of those issues that people are quite confused about, the amount that we actually spend, isn't it, Kieran?
Yes, one of the things that we find in our polling is actually when we ask people about different types of government spending and whether they think it should be increased or decreased, we actually find that around 75% of the public will say that international aid should have its budget cut. But actually, when you tell people how much is spent on international aid, just 0.7% of GDP, then we find that actually six in 10 say that that's either about right or not enough. So there is a big gap between initially what people think is being spent, and they think that there's too much money going abroad, but then once they're told the reality, their opinion changes.
Why don't cabinet ministers, at least on the Conservative side, agree with the people you're polling?
Well, I think there's a strong feeling amongst Conservative backbenchers that international aid should be cut. I think this is something that is a Conservative Party internal issue, and I think that it may be, to an extent, suits the government to at least allow the public to think that there are areas where there is too much money being spent that can be cut.
Ian Collins is with us, the LBC radio presenter. How do your listeners feel about international aid?
Well, I mean, it is interesting, because I've often wondered, because you look at the Tory front bench and some people, you know, think they are just sort of rich, privileged, out-of-touch toffs.
Yeah, as opposed to the diverse makeup of men and female that they are, of course.
Their critics can be even more harsh. Yeah. Some people do have that view, and it's suggested that they keep the aid budget there because it somehow offsets that perception of them. Now, whether it is that or not, I don't know. I got into an argument at a police federation conference with the police minister when I suggested, you know, why not put... You're cutting budgets to the police, but you know the international aid budget increased.
Yeah, I've got the quote. You said, why don't we just lop it off the international aid budget, to quote.
Yes, and clearly there was a lot of support from the police officers in the room, but not a lot of support from Damien Green, who thought it was the worst thing I'd ever said. You know, it was like I almost shot his dog at that point. He looked so disgruntled by the idea, but then went on to sort of create the moral argument. Well, I feel quite proud that we save starving people and help people grow crops, etc. Well, obviously, on the face of it, nobody disagrees with that point, but he was sort of playing that moral card to offset any argument. You know, you start putting or waving examples of famine and starvation in front of people, it becomes very hard to argue
really
back, even if you want to do so intellectually.
Kieran Pedley from ComRes, welfare is another issue. What do people think when it comes to people claiming benefit and not working?
Well, again, one of the things that the government hopes long-term is that their message on welfare is the one, it actually is the thing that has public support. And, you know, you see all the time that David Cameron stands up at the dispatch box and wants to show Ed Miliband and Ed Balls as being people that are soft on welfare. And I think to an extent there is a public perception out there that would support that. Around 4 in 10 think that half or more of those on welfare are quote-unquote scroungers, as in they are claiming benefits that they are not entitled to, which is a startling number when you consider that actually it's around like 0.7% of welfare claimants.
Is it so that they can make reforms and then, you know, use that moral argument, the emotional blackmail, if you will?
If you give the government some credit, that, you know, the welfare budget is large, and, you know, I don't want to pass judgment on what should and shouldn't be cut, but, you know, there is a lot of money there that could potentially be reduced in terms of spending.
Here, here with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Ian Collins with us in studio, still the LBC radio presenter, political commentator, and as we found out, presenter of Ian Collins Wants a Word. Isn't the problem in politics, from Prime Minister's questions with all the theatrics, isn't the problem that it's actually infotainment, it's an act of entertainment rather than sometimes the important nitty-gritty that we need?
Yeah, I mean, there is some of that. And, I said at the beginning that I thought this week's Prime Minister's question time was, you know, just a great example, or a terrible example, if you like, of political discourse just gone really badly. But the day before that, of course, which I thought was more interesting, that everybody wanted to shoot down the entire chamber because of taking the issue of health, as I think lots of commentators called it, into the gutter. There you had left blaming right, right blaming left, or conservatives versus Labour, if you like. I actually thought that kind of gladiatorial locking horns type debate is Parliament at its best, actually.
That's PMQs. You know, that's not normally the case of things like health questions. That's not normally the case.
No, but obviously with health, they were looking at a report and they were looking at, you know, some really serious stories about what had happened beyond mid-staffs, what had gone on, you know, Morecambe, Cumbria, Manchester. We know about that. These were new stories where we'd heard that, you know, people had died not because they were terminally ill, but because they were thirsty. In the United Kingdom in the 21st century, people were dying because they were thirsty. Now, the severity of that doesn't really need to be underlined. What is interesting is whose fault it is. And this, of course, then descends, and it goes back to sort of perception and reality. I did say on Twitter, you know, how many people had to have died under a Labour administration before we can safely conclude that maybe Labour are not the party of the NHS after all.
Because, but of course, then they all cock it up, frankly.
Well, indeed, and that is always my point. You do struggle with social media in the sense that if at any point you were to say, you know, I think Labour have got this wrong, somebody thinks you're making a pro-Tory point.
Yeah, but do we always need the blame? We're in this blame culture. There's got to be some accountability.
Whoever's in power has to shoulder a certain amount of blame. Of course they do. Black Wednesday is a good example. When the Tories were in power, you know, Labour slightly staggeringly tried to sort of almost blame David Cameron, even though he was virtually the work experience boy at the time. Nonetheless, you know, Labour had signed up to all the same monetary elements of that. It would have happened under Labour. And as I said before, the banking crash would have happened under the Tories. But whoever is in power, whoever is the stewards at that time, has to shoulder the blame. Now, unfortunately for Labour, when youth unemployment had its most sustained rise in history, Labour were in power. When we committed to a couple of wars that many suggest are illegal, Labour were in power. When the banks crashed, Labour were in power. Now, you can get into the minutiae of that and say, actually, you know, you've got to think about why this happened or that happened, or there's a reason for this, or you've got to factor in this component. And all of that may well be true. But you can't run away from the fact that whoever is in power at that time shoulders the blame. Andy Burnham, for example, I mean, back to the health issue, you know, Andy Burnham did try and get an inquiry going. It's very rarely the specific individual minister's fault, as if they somehow sat there in a side of a cave, sort of James Bond style, stroking a cat, barking instructions at minions. It's not specifically their fault, but if they are the person who carries the title of that job, that is their portfolio, they take the blame. So whatever happens now, health-wise, will be Jeremy Hunt's fault.
But they don't do that so much as they used to. Lord Carrington resigned over the Falklands. We all know John Perfumo resigned over the whole Christine Keeler affair. It's very rare that you get ministers taking that accountability. And so I put it to you that that accountability finds itself in the pages of the Daily Mail. People can criticise it, but they highlight issues. It appears in the Telegraph. It appears out there for the public to assess. And because that accountability isn't taken, I put it to you that that's why people don't have respect for politicians.
I think, yeah, I think there is a bit of that. I mean, the other aspect of this that fascinates me, and this was, you know, a prolonged debate that I and many had with people via Twitter and Facebook, was this business about whose fault the health issue was. You know, if you are a lefty, it's like, you know, for many people, it's like supporting football teams. If you are a diehard Chelsea fan and you see John Terry kick somebody in the face in a particular mucky foul at Stamford Bridge, then you will decide that John Terry did not do what everybody saw him do.
No, the man headbutted his foot.
That's exactly what happened. Everybody saw Rooney deliberately try and target John Terry's foot, and that's how it is. Unless, of course, you're a United fan, then you clearly saw it the other way, and that's what happens. And even with something as serious as health, there were people just completely ignoring the facts of the matter and deciding to put their view and ultimately their vote with whichever party they usually have always voted for and the party they intend to vote for in 2015.
He's been Ian Collins. He's got an opinion or two. You can hear some of those on Twitter.
At Ian Collins UK.
And you do Facebook as well.
Which is /IanCollinsUK.
Fantastic. Right, Ian Collins there joining us as the guest of the week for the Hear Hear show. Problem with perception versus reality in politics is it all seems to be a little bit of an entertainment game. That's the conclusion we're forced to come to, speaking to comrades, speaking to Martin Robbins, and indeed the political commentator Ian Collins. Join us next week on the Hear Hear show when our guest will be the UKIP leader, Nigel Farage. He's got David Cameron worried, as well as Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg. But what's your view? Could you possibly vote UKIP at the next election?
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audioboo.